Hi, this is Katie Day and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh, sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Terry Bratton. Terry has 20 years experience of working in education, finding and developing children's individual gifts. She has also worked with adults with profound and multiple learning difficulties. Terry's master's work on adolescent development, The Identity Project, was written into the national curriculum in 1999 and is used by schools all around the country. Her absolute passion is looking at the brain and how it works in teaching and learning for both adults and children to help them discover their hidden talents. Her work is informed by study, practical experience, and research. In order to make the best of individual gifts, a person needs to know what to look for and how to make those gifts work for them. Terry was nominated for the National Teaching Awards for 5 consecutive years. Terry enjoys travelling to support teachers in remote areas and has been responsible for twinning schools in Nepal with the UK. Terry is a master practitioner and certified trainer of neuro-linguistic programming and certified clarity coach encompassing the 3 principles. Thank you, Terry, for being willing to be interviewed. There's lots in there that's really interesting that as I was reading it out, so I must ask her about that. And oh, that's interesting, what's that mean? And I must ask her about that. You've got a fascinating history, and to be 5 consecutive years for the National Teaching Awards, how wonderful is that?
Yeah, I was very flattered. That was by the students, and a lovely lot they were too. So, yeah.
And did you win?
No, because I was something called an advanced skills teacher at the time, and right. I didn't fit into a category.
Oh, okay.
But it was still nice to be nominated.
Well, if it 5 years in a row, they should have written in a category just for you, I think. Yeah. There was a message there in those nominations. So tell us more about what you do today. I mean, I loved the Identity Project. So let's reframe that. What does the Identity Project mean? Because it's such a wonderful title. Can you tell us more about what that was?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I didn't enter education until my 30s. So I started studying around the age of 33. I didn't actually go into teaching until I was maybe about 36. And the first thing I noticed in a secondary school was that there were a lot of pictures on the walls of pop groups, self-portraits, vases of flowers, but nothing that told me anything about the students that I was working with. Okay. And so very quickly, actually, in my first year of teaching, I decided to devise this project, which supported the students looking at how they saw themselves, how they'd like to be seen, how they thought other people saw them, and just to get the dialogue going. And so as a result of doing that, sort of looking into the research, it seemed like age kind of 15, 16 was a really good time to be looking at these issues. And so the Identity Project was formed, and it was fascinating because the students were producing images that some of them had never painted before, which surprised me. But so they were trying out different materials, experimenting, using 3D as well as 2D images. But they also started to keep a diary, a journal. They were writing poetry. They were writing letters. They were really beginning to question their own beliefs and values. And I found that fascinating.
Mm.
And as a result of that, what was quite interesting is that they never had one final piece, because as they were working towards their thoughts in that moment, they realised their thoughts were changing. And so then they would produce, oh, I don't think this now, I think this now. And with the understanding that I've got currently of the 3 principles, looking at the role that thought has to play in our experiences of everyday life. I wish I'd have had more information then, because I could have spoken about that, how we're living in the feeling of our thinking. And but anyway, at that time, they were producing lots and lots of various images, and all did really well at A level. They all got amazing grades. And it's fascinating, because for a teacher teaching that subject now, if they are totally into the students and care about where they're coming from, and I know the majority of teachers in this country do, it has a massive impact. Mm. But it's not a project that you could just walk in and think, oh, I'm going to do the identity project and say, oh, well, draw how you see yourself. Because you could easily end up with the same pop groups, the same self-portraits and the same vases of flowers, you know. But it had a tremendous impact. And then I wondered what would happen if I went into schools with the tiny reception children. And so I started to do that and say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And sort of worded it slightly differently. Mm. And then we're right the way through. So through the whole of the infant school, then the junior school, the whole of secondary, and then out into colleges, and then further into with working with old age pensioners.
Gosh, oh my gosh.
So it became an enormous project called The World Begins With Me. And Dame Tamsin Imerson, who's an incredibly close friend of mine, came out to open the exhibition in the first place. She heard I was giving a talk at Leicester City Football Stadium, all things, just as one of the guest speakers there, and met Tamsin there, and she became very interested, and she opened the exhibition. And so my fascination really is people right the way through any age. But I went into school, and that's how the identity project began.
So how did you position that with teenagers who at the age of 16 are hugely resistant to practically everything that a grown-up presents to them? So how did you get them from where they were into the space where they were willing to do this exploration on themselves?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Well, I had a good rapport with students in a very short space of time. Mm. I'd worked as an art therapist for a little while.
Right.
But something took me into mainstream education. And so we had quite a good connected sort of relationship anyway, I think, in a very short space of time. And I just started asking questions, you know, and questions around it was a community college I was in, where in the college do you have an opportunity to talk about how you see life? Where in the college do you show your beliefs and your values and what you stand for? And they were telling me they didn't have that opportunity. So I did some digging around and asking staff, and they actually, on the whole, agreed. They said, well, really, they don't, apart from in a tutor time. Hmm. And they saw tutor time as a time to get together with their friends, if I'm honest. They didn't see it as any sort of deep exploration. So I told them of this idea, and I said, look, would you be interested in looking at this? And it was a big class, and they were interested, and fascinatingly, other students became interested who weren't doing the art A-level. And so I'd only literally just gone into education. I found myself working until 9 at night because it was community college. It was open to the community anyway.
Right.
And students, the A-level students didn't want to stop what they were doing. And other students were saying, can we become involved in this project?
Wow.
So it really did become a community of students working together. And then I remember a French teacher coming to see me saying, look, I'm really interested. And then she said, well, perhaps I could run it for the students in my classroom. And she did. And that really got me thinking, because they saw it as an exercise and a chore rather than something that, like, they'd really got into this. And then I started to realise very quickly it does depend on the way the students are approached about it. So I think she'd gone in one day and thought, I'm doing this, and said, okay, today we're looking at, and in French, you know, how you see yourselves. A lot of those students were already in my class, and I think they just thought, oh, we're already doing this. And so they, you know, it didn't work as well. But I think with a motivated member of staff, introducing it and really, really having a connected conversation with their classes, it's a brilliant project to run.
Amazing. So it was written into the national curriculum. Is it still used by schools, the Identity Project?
Yes, it is. Still used. My daughter is the head of art of a school in Norwich, and she's already planning the Identity Project for this coming year.
Wow.
And she's, you know, we have lots of discussions about that. And,
wow.
I'm incredibly interested. So yes, it's still used.
Do you train teachers how to position it and how to run it, or do you let it be free fall and organic depending on the teacher?
I haven't to be honest. I was very flattered at the time, new to education, and I used it as part of my master's degree, as you know. I did once think, oh, this needs to be a book, I need to write this into a book, and I thought that would help staff, but no, I haven't done that. But with the kind of added on bit, because I've done lots of coaching training as well since that project. And I think now I would go in with a new understanding, and I would approach it just the way I did before, but I would do a bit of teaching about the way we think and how thought affects our experiences. So, yeah, I suppose I've got a little bit of thinking about how I would do it differently now.
Yeah.
I've just recently been contacted. I mean, I don't just only work in education, but I've been contacted by somebody who would like me to get involved in some research in a high school in Norfolk. And I was talking about this project, and he was saying, well, actually, this is an opportunity to revisit the project.
And, okay.
And certainly working with my daughter, I'd be very interested to see how it changes within her school.
Yeah. Have you heard from any of the original students from the original project of what they're doing now?
I have, funnily enough. But we're talking several years ago. I'm nearly 60. And as I say, I went to education when I was about 35, 36, I think. Maybe 37. So I kept in touch with them over a long period of time. And some of them are on Facebook. I get to just see how they're doing.
Yeah.
Several of them have got babies now.
Gosh.
But I know one guy who is particularly talented went into the church. He became a minister, as far as I know.
Gosh.
But he does talk about what he got from them. They still talk about it, you know, what they got from actually doing that work. So it did seem to be the optimum time to be doing that kind of work.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I've just back from a trip to India, and what we know, and we actually did some training for the Bombay Teachers Training College, so we had 50 trainee teachers in the room and we took them through an exercise of how the brain thinks. So to understand that you've got a room full of students, the chances are you are going to present the lesson in your thinking style. Just bear in mind, you're probably only hitting 25% of your class. And the other 75% are likely to shut down because they don't understand what you're teaching them in the way that you're teaching it. So we took them through our balanced thinking grid and got them standing in the four quarters of the room and saying, okay, you know, if you're top left and you've got a class full of bottom right, how are you going to change your lesson to meet these students? So that was really fascinating. But what we find in India particularly, it's a very didactic form and way of teaching. So people aren't taught how to think. So we have been asked to put together a critical thinking program because people are not taught how to think. They are taught how to learn, but they are given information, but what they're not given is knowledge and the application of that information. So when you say, you know, you're really, your passion is looking at the brain and how it works and teaching, and also, you know, the Identity Project. So few people, let alone students, have the opportunity to press the pause button on their lives and think. Because we go through life being dictated to, don't we? From the moment we're born, really, from our parents telling us what to do or what not to do, then teachers, then bosses. And to actually just kind of get off that train and stand on the platform and choose whether or not you want to get back on it again doesn't come along that often to people. So, you know, the gift that you gave people and continue to give to people, because it's now the national curriculum, is absolutely huge. Have you taken it outside of the UK?
No, I haven't, but I'd like to. I'd like the opportunity to do that. Yeah, I'd love to. I go to Nepal and work with teachers and children in Nepal. So that's obviously just to the north of India. And I do understand what you're saying about sort of teaching being quite didactic when you're there. So it's something that, you know, it's great that you're going out there and you're looking at those things. And it, I find it so amazing how things sort of turn in a full circle because, you know, there was all this learning to learn in school, and I got very involved in that and wrote some bits myself for that, for training in it, for teaching in several schools and for training teachers how to do that. And there came a point in time where learning styles were poo-pooed at one stage.
Right.
And I thought, isn't that interesting? And the reason was that staff were saying, oh, little Johnny, you're a kinesthetic learner. Little Johnny can only learn this way.
Right.
Rather than, there are several learning styles, and, okay, you are really good in this area. Let's get these other skills up, and these are some of the ways we can do it. I think that younger children as well, teachers began to label them because they thought this was what was required of them. And the Education Foundation Trust have just pulled out a paper talking about the importance of learning to learn and learning styles and so on. So what you're doing in India is brilliant. And I've just been called into, I do a lot of teaching about the growth mindset based on Carol Dweck's work. And I've just been asked to go into a school to speak about metacognition and various other things, which is everything that it sounds like you're doing in India at the moment. And it's great. I mean, it's lovely to be made to think, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I love it when I'm challenged and I have to think outside of the box. And there is no one particular right answer. You know, we can. Yeah, and so even if you've got, you know, a grade A student in your class, you know, ask them how they got to that answer. You know, asking them those deeper questions to help them to think about, rather than just becoming, who was it who said, I can't remember the quote, an ASNN, I think. It said something like, if I were in charge for a day, I would give all the A grade students, this isn't the exact quote, but like, give them C's for being great parrots. And I give all the C grade students who tried and failed and tried again and did it, I'd give them the A's or something like this. And I just think that's a really good point. It's a really good point because it was O-levels when I was at school. And I remember, you know, taking my O-levels, and I just cited a lot of information. And then the minute I'd taken them, the knowledge seemed to drop out of my head.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be that really as a child, you get ahead with your ability to memorise, not your ability to learn. And there's a huge difference between the two. You know, memorising information to get through an exam doesn't give you life knowledge. And it's fascinating. I heard a wonderful story a few years ago. I don't know if it's true, but I loved it. And it was a story that came from California, that two teachers were approached in the state of California and were told that in the state of California, they'd been identified as the two best teachers in the state, and that they were given a year to work with a group of students who are identified as A students, the best students in the state of California, to see what they could do with them for a year. And at the end of the year, these students just, you know, just were off the scale in what they achieved, and they were told, actually, you weren't the two best teachers in California, and actually, they weren't the 30 best students in California. And it was just a lesson in our perception of what we're told and how we project that out and how we can make assumptions. So, you know, if we go into schools, if teachers go into a school within a, in inverted commas, challenging area, they will go in likely with a preconceived idea of who they're going to be faced with and how they're going to respond and will act and behave accordingly. And I just thought that was a fascinating story about human nature and unconscious bias and how that can get in the way with so many things, can't it, that unconscious bias?
Absolutely, it can. I was head of school for a while in this academy in Norfolk, and I would say to the teachers, meet the children at the door, meet the students at the door with your biggest smile and welcome them into your room. But what I hadn't taken into account, and I see this in retrospect, it's not even just about meeting someone with a smile at the door, because children would come to see me and say, well, Mrs. So-and-so wasn't very happy to see me today, even though she was stood at the door and greeting me into the room. And so what I realise more than ever now, since I've just left, funnily enough, is that it is absolutely about making a connection with the people that are in front of you, whether they're the staff, whether they're the children, or, you know, admin, cleaning. So I've been doing these trainings of late and saying to the head, how about inviting your cleaners and your admin staff? And if this is what you want to do as a school, let's get everybody in there so we're all singing from the same hymn sheet. And that appears to be working really well, because they're sort of talking, it's the language of the school, and they're talking to the children about it. The children are talking about it to the dinner lady or whoever, and they've all got a general understanding.
Yeah.
So that's been very interesting. And that story, yeah, I've told it. I don't know where it comes from either.
It's fascinating, isn't it, if it's true? I kind of hope it is true, but, you know, who knows? Who knows? And so there was another story of a president visiting NASA, and had a lineup of people, and the janitor at the end, and he says, and what do you do? He said, I help put men on the moon. Because, you know, if the loos are unclean and they get sick, they're not going anywhere. And I thought, you know, that, and it is just the story that you've just said, is recognising it doesn't matter who you are, that we all play a part in the whole, don't we? And it's easy for people to forget that. You know, it's easy for people to get sucked into a hierarchy and have a sense of entitlement based on what happens to be their job title at any given time.
Community is really important to me. And just before I left the academy, I would run these projects with the children. We'd have days off timetable. So there was one called 1,000 Voices. So the governors and it was everybody, it was parents, people in the school, were able to talk a little bit about themselves, including all of the students. So that was a 1,000 Voices project. And there was another one that they were able to ask a provocative question for a day. And so something like, my Nazi Germany, or, you know, really provocative.
Gosh.
Just to look at things from a different perspective, rather than what we're educated to believe the whole time. They were able to ask anything and research it and find out for themselves. It comes back to this sort of the ability to go and think. Anyway, one of those days, just before I left, I thought, we'll have a community day and the students can go off and they can run it for themselves. And do you know what? Everybody in that school, and I mean everybody down to sort of the cleaning staff, the admin staff, the dinner, everybody, the senior leaders, all staff, were involved in one way or another, setting up stalls, coming up with ideas. We had a tank in the school, a double-decker bus. They were making food. You name it, they produced it and owned it. And they raised money for one of the schools that I'm working in Nepal. That they're twinned with. And, you know, if you give people half a chance to think for themselves, they will.
Mm.
you know, and get they can see its relation to the world and the wider world, not just this classroom, this moment, this time. It's sort of, oh yeah, this is how this fits in with what's going on out there. So yeah, community, important to me.
Very, very, and it is important. So why and how Nepal?
Well, that's interesting. Well, my husband and I met some. I'm also a painter and ceramicist and various other things. Not that I've had an opportunity to do much over the last few years, but and then somebody said, "Look, we're running a project in Kenya, and we'd like my husband to come along to do some building works to get street children somewhere to live. And would I be prepared to go and paint murals on the walls and everything?" Mm. I was very keen to go. Well, we both were. And so we went to Kenya, long journey. We flew to Nairobi and then out to a place called Kakamega in Kenya. Met some amazing people. These kids were just so streetwise. Mm. And one of the ladies who was running the team asked my husband and I if we would like to go out and give some bread to the street children that evening. And of course we agreed, we'd never been before. So we were taken after this long journey out in a jeep in the night time. We could see fires in the street, which apparently the children slept around. AIDS was rife out there, still is, I think, as far as I know. And we were handing out bread, popcorn, a drink of juice, I think that was it. But in return, we had to ask these street boys for their plastic bags, and they had been to the shoe menders and got glue, and they were sniffing glue.
Gosh.
And apparently this helped them sleep in the evening, so there was lots of sort of unhealthy things going on between the boys. Mm. I probably don't need to go into all the details. And so our job was to give them food in return for their bag. And I had a little bit of a question in my head at the time. If this glue helps them to sleep, and this glue is what they do habitually and have done for a long time, how is me handing a roll and popcorn and taking it away supporting them? So I questioned that in my own head. And then whilst we were doing it, because we were new and hadn't been before, whilst we were doing this, a couple of people were taking photographs, and then I just saw this sort of caption as a headline. It wasn't going into any newspaper, but this sort of benevolent white couple feed poor black street children and take their glue or whatever. And I just, this is not what I'm about, not why I'm coming out here.
Yeah.
I certainly wanted to support in some way, but I didn't believe at the time it was the right way to go about it. Mm. And so I had a bad taste in my mouth. And then my husband and I, he did the work in the compound, and I was painting the murals. And one that I'm particularly proud of, although the children weren't supposed to be in helping us, there was a time when a few did get in, and I was getting them, each of them, when they came in, to put their hands onto a wall and then painting around their hand, thinking about identity.
Yeah.
Meaning that would always be their handprint on the wall, and making it into some sort of African pattern, and really proud of that. And there were maps of Africa and various other things, patterns. And when I got home, it was a good trip. We were there for 3 weeks, but still I had questions in my head about this. I mean, they do an amazing job, these people, and I don't want to say otherwise. But for me, that just stuck in my throat a bit. And I was telling a friend of mine, a fellow coach, when I arrived home, and he said, "Well, you'd be very interested in meeting a friend of mine who's a Gurkha and runs a children's charity in Nepal."
Mm.
And so we went to an evening where they were raising money. Saved up enough money and decided to go over there for a few weeks, and I absolutely fell in love. I have never been to such crazy conditions. It's way up high in the mountains. It's 10-hour drive from Kathmandu. It's just looks like paradise, but it's scary. The roads are scary. They have no money. We ate bees and quite unusual things while we were there. But they were so pleased for us to be there, supporting the children in their education. And their sense of community is like I have never seen. And I fell in love with the women's groups, with the children. And that's the call to keep going back, I guess. So that's how Nepal. I remember one specific time I was giving a talk to a women's group. Some men had come in as well, so it was quite a big crowd of people. Do you know what? The Red Cross had put in a tap in the village, but they have nothing, these people. They just look so beautiful in their saris and colours. You know all about this.
Yeah, it's amazing. So, and I've been to Nepal. It's the most incredible country, and the people are staggeringly humble and gracious and charming and happy. And yeah, and going through villages and seeing how proud the children are with absolutely nothing, and they look immaculate. Yeah, I don't know how they do it.
But I was giving this talk to through a translator to this group, and again, there's that word connection, but felt very connected to the people that were there. There was a love that was beyond words, and there was one particular woman. The average age of this particular village is 34, because a lot of women die in childbirth, and there's one particular woman. I was just so drawn to her. And when we came out, I looked, you know, I'm nearly five foot four, and they're much smaller than I am. They sort of pinch my arms. and when we came out, she kept touching her heart and then putting her hand on my heart and touching her heart again. And in her way, she was talking about a connection.
Mm.
And then she started speaking in Nepali. And I said to Jai, the translator, what is she saying? And he said, she's saying, I dance for this moment. And as she said it, a drum, I think it's called a mardal, they started playing this drum. And she started dancing her beautiful dance. And I realised that was the first time in my entire life. It didn't matter to me who was watching. You know, I go out to a party and need a couple of drinks and then shyly get onto the dance floor. There was none of that. It was absolutely being in that moment and dancing for that moment, which hit me. But what the learning from that is that, do you know what? We could dance for this moment anytime. You know, now, right here in this conversation, we can dance for this moment. And I didn't realise that for a couple of years, really. You know, it's only dawned on me of late that, you know, with that, you know, the past has happened, the future will happen. We've got now, and let's do what we can right now, right here. I sound like a preacher, don't I? But I feel so passionately about that.
Yeah, I mean that living in the moment is all we have, isn't it? Which is why it's called the present, because it's an incredible gift, the moment, isn't it? And we are getting better at it, but I think people in the West struggle to live in the now, because we have the distractions that other people don't have. So, you know, it's very easy in the West to think that we're privileged, because on the surface we have more material comforts. But I'm not sure that necessarily brings privilege, because what we lose a result of that is something that other people have in abundance that we are searching for and striving for in the West, I think, which is why, you know, we feel pulled to other cultures, you know, particularly in the East, you know, particularly India, Nepal, in China. We get drawn towards the old way of living, when you have to be fully present in that moment, because that's all you have. And, you know, in India, because the difference in the haves and the have-nots is so stark, And we were talking to them about critical thinking and the ability to think laterally and creatively. And we say, you know, the people on the streets are much better at critical thinking than you are. And you, on the surface of it, have everything because you're living in the city that probably has the most expensive real estate in the world, in Mumbai. But the people in the slums are much better at thinking than you are, because they have to be to survive.
That's fascinating, Katie. I was looking at a very recent report by Bupa about mental well-being. Mm-hmm. And the statistics, I can't quote them all, they were something like 48% of the population in the UK, you'd need to double check this, have been treated for some sort of well-being issue. Mm-hmm. And I find that crazy. You know, I go out to Nepal, and you know, people are looking after each other's children. If somebody hasn't, I arranged to have some ice lollies taken to this mountain. That was no mean feat.
But it wasn't.
They came in a sort of polystyrene box. They were melting by the time they got there. And I watched these kids with the ice lollies, and there was enough for one. They couldn't get enough, so there was enough for one between two. And I was watching these children. One would take just a small lick of the lolly and then pass it to the person opposite them who would have a lick, and they'd take it. There was no, you've had more than me, you know, I'm sure it's my turn now, or pulling of wrists, just total sharing, you know, really just again in the moment and sharing what they had.
Mm. It's we can learn some incredibly important lessons, can't we? Which is why it's important for me to go to these countries. And what was really weird from this trip is that from Mumbai, we flew to Dubai. Oh, my Lord. Talk about
stark differences.
which reality is actually real here? I mean, what's going on? You know, it's like walking on Dubai is like living in a Disney set. You know, you expect a director to say lights, camera, action, because this can't be real, is it?
No,
is this real life? No,
yeah.
No, this is just a fantasy land.
Yeah, I've never been just to the airport.
Mad place, completely insane. But I know which one I prefer.
Yeah.
And it isn't
but
Dubai.
You know what? Reality is in our head, isn't it?
It is.
I feel that we create our reality. It's sort of where we are in that moment. And, you know, if I've got some sad thinking, then I'm going to have a sad reality. And if I've got some happy thinking, I've got a happy reality, you know, and it could be the same situation. I know that sounds very simplistic, the way I'm putting it, but I think I do believe that we create our own reality.
But what's wrong with simplistic? And as human beings, are we obsessed with making things complicated in order to give them some validity? And actually, does life have to be that complicated? Why can't we do simple and be content with simple? You know, sometimes I question this. You know, and again, I think it's something about the West. I do think we complicate things to try and be clever sometimes, rather than just accepting that actually this is simple and that's okay. We don't have to make it complicated to make it have some kind of validity and importance in our lives. So simple is good. Simple is good. So what are the three principles? Tell us more about that and clarity coaching. That's fascinating.
Certainly. Well, what a journey. So whilst, as I said, I didn't go into education until very late, because I grew up with an understanding that I wasn't intelligent and that I would never achieve anything. And I had certain messages that were given to me, and I took on board hook, line and sinker. And so I'm coming to clarity coaching in a roundabout way. And so what happened, I took an A-level in pottery. When I was about 33, I think. I've always loved the arts. And then whilst I was doing that, somebody said, do you know what, you could do an A-level in painting. And so I did that as well. And as the course came to an end, I think it was only a year, they said, oh, there's this thing that's come out called a BTEC. Would you like to do that? So I did the BTEC. during that time, unfortunately, my marriage broke up. But I've got an absolute thirst for learning. And what I once believed to be true seemed to be being shaken up. Whilst I would have still told you I had no confidence, that I wasn't intelligent, all the rest of it. So I had an opportunity to go to university. So off I go to university and manage to get a first-class honours degree. And all the time thinking, this is a fluke, this is a fluke. And then worked as, did some training in art therapy, worked as an art therapist. And as you know, sort of went into school and the identity project and so on. But all the time, we've spoken about community and a love of people in general. I thought, goodness, there must be. So I did a little bit of counselling training. Wasn't quite what I was looking for. So then I started to look at coaching. So I did some advanced coaching courses, and they were great, and lots of new tools. And then I did the NLP to master practitioner and trainer level. But all the time thinking, this is great. If this is so great, why am I feeling great all the time? Why? I don't know. I just felt that something was missing. And I remember certainly on my trainer's training, and lovely, it was a lovely trainer, lovely people. But I would walk into the room and someone would say, how are you today? And I'd say, I'm good, thank you. And they'd say, only good. You know, and I think, well, actually, good's good enough for me. It's good enough for me. And, there was this, and there are a few things, you know, there's some fantastic tools in there, but still there was a question in my mind, something was missing. And so a few years went by, and I did something called Institute of Leadership and Management, level 7 it's called, in executive coaching and mentoring. I thought, well, maybe the answer's here. And no, it wasn't. I mean, I was using it in work all the time, but still something for me was missing. And then I retired at this time last year, actually, just this time last year, and was given an opportunity to join the Clarity coaching course with Jamie Smart. And fundamentally what underlies that is something called the three principles of mind, thought, and consciousness. And I think said alone like that, they don't mean very much. It just, sort of just sounds a bit complicated. But the bottom line is that we are living in the feeling of our thinking 100% of the time.
Right.
We turn thought into form. We make it into things. We kind of turn the formless, something that we're thinking about, into form. We make it like the reality. And actually, even just that one understanding, we're feeling our thinking 100% of the time. I thought, well, that's interesting. Maybe want to learn a little bit more about it. This one understanding, plus other things, and amazing things have happened, and connection to people on the course and in my coaching practice, this one understanding has led me from being having an absolute fear and terror of public speaking. You know, I used to run a school, but I still had this awful terror of public speaking. And with all my skills that I'd gained from these other courses, I don't think anyone had actually said to me, well, you're feeling your thinking, Terry. Mm-hmm. It's not who you are. Fundamentally, it's not who you are. It hadn't even occurred to me. And so even just that, and what I realised was I was feeling my habitual thinking, because I think certain things over years and years and years and years, and they became my truth. But they aren't true at all. And if thoughts are like clouds that pass by in a sky, who's the seer of those thoughts?
Mm-hmm.
And so I became very aware of my habitual thinking patterns and realising that actually I am the seer of those thoughts. And if I imagine a sort of conveyor belt. Do you remember the generation
game? I do, yeah.
Like a conveyor belt of thoughts going by. Just naturally, you know, we're born naturally for parts, you know, we're thinking beings, so thoughts pass through us. And I think when we get to a point where I don't know. It could be that we're happy, but when we're really struggling, we tend to put thought on top of thought on top of thought. We look for evidence to prove it, yeah. And so on. And I feel that it sort of sticks the conveyor belt, and it doesn't allow the thought to naturally pass through. And therefore, we become very caught up in our thinking in the moment. But actually, just this one understanding of realizing that thoughts actually are made to just pass through us. That's what happens. That's what they do. Good, bad, indifferent. We all have them. So this isn't all about positive thinking. Because, you know, it would be useless to say there are no weeds in my garden, knowing that there's weeds out there. But it's an understanding. It's an understanding of the connectedness of all things, of us, of humans. And I see this more and more as I work with people. And the fact that there's something sort of greater than us. And I don't know what you call that, spirit, God, the universe. Something, you know, that connects us to each other.
How do you work with people whose thoughts are as a result of projections from other people that have happened over years and have then become their reality? So I absolutely get what you say about, you know, the thoughts on the conveyor belt that kind of come through. And sometimes they get stuck and we can choose to let them carry on going or stop, look at it and think, is this a helpful thought or not, and let it go. But when it's not our thoughts, when it's somebody else's thoughts about us that are projected onto us, so we haven't invited it and we're not necessarily in control of that. We're in control of how we react to it, but we only come to that realization potentially as adults. Unlikely to come to that realization as children. How do you then get people to move, get that conveyor belt moving again when that thought has become their reality over decades?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I've got loads of examples in my head, and I'm not sure whether to use myself as one. The lady that I'm working with currently, so I think I'll use her. So I'm working with a lady currently who has... Well, tells me she has agoraphobia,
right?
That she has anxiety issues, that there's just a list as long as my arm of what she's telling me is wrong. So she heard about me through word of mouth. So I called to see her and I gave her a 2-hour session and charged her nothing because I wanted to see how this works. I asked her what she'd done before. She'd had, funnily enough, NLP. She'd had some hypnosis. She'd been given medication from her GP that made her feel very sick. I don't know, various CBT, various interventions. Some had short-term efficacy, but on the whole, not much was changing. And she was beside herself.
Hmm.
So what did I do? The first thing I did was talk about the nature of thought. And I took an old plastic bottle with me, and there's some building going on down the road, so I took some sharp sand, and I put some water in the bottle, and I gave it a jolly good shake when I was in the room. Spoke about the nature of thought, that the water had gone incredibly muddy in the bottle. You couldn't even see the particles, it was just complete mud. And I sat the bottle on the side while I was speaking to her. And so I'm talking about the nature of thought. And then throughout the conversation, just slowly, the mud began to clear and settle at the bottom. And it was still orange by the time I'd left, but it was clearing, and it was, and you could see the particles going around. So we spoke about the nature of thought and messages that we're given throughout our lives. And she told me some of the messages, and we spoke about how that was in her thinking, very obviously in her thinking, and why wouldn't it be? Because she kept thinking about those particular messages that she had been given. And then we looked at how we process information. And And, you know, I did use a model there. I spoke about how we delete, we distort, we generalize information that's given to us. And then I went through all the sort of meta programs, memories, beliefs, values, and so on. And then we say, oh, this means that. But we're all doing it. You know, I'm not the only person. You know, we're all doing this all the time. And then we come out with, oh, well, this means this. So we aren't necessarily looking at, oh, this person has an issue. And then from there on, I actually took a model of the brain. I was able to show her where the hippocampus was. We spoke a little bit about that and how it functions. I know that we've got a very short time. So what I'm just going to say now is that this was 4 weeks ago. She's since then been to a barbecue of a best friend of 30 years. She's never been to this woman's house.
Wow.
She's come to her last session to my house.
Wow.
The next session, we're walking in woods, which is about 10 miles from here. It's a shame we don't have longer to go into this because it's fascinating. And I'm watching people drop the messages they've been given over years, including myself. Stunning.
Fascinating.
And it's based on something called the Three Principles.
Fascinating.
Sid James, if somebody's interested, they might want to look up Sid. Sid James, or Sydney Banks, sorry.
Because Sid James was a Carry-On actor, wasn't he? Fantastic. Well, it is a real shame that we're over by a minute and 7 seconds, but never mind. We'll have to come back and explore this in more detail. It's absolutely fascinating. And yeah, actually on a personal level, I want to have a chat with you after the interview. So thanks, Terry. It's absolutely wonderful. Bless you for a fabulous interview. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Katie Day and Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.